This meeting is now being recorded.
Do we have anybody else on the phone? All right, for now, we'll just leave it at that. Rose, did you want to make an announcement? Rose, please.
She did. I will go ahead and do so. I'm just going to remind everybody that this is a public meeting and that we are recording the meeting. And Judge, if you want to go ahead and start by opening the meeting, then I'll take roll afterward.
All right. And also, Rose is going to have has in the back a shuttle list, anyone that needs it, so just check with her when she gets back. But we're going to go ahead and start the meeting. I want to welcome Judge Bremer and Ms. Sloan. You go by Bonnie? Okay.
Kim from Marin.
And Mr. Kim from James,
yes,
from Marin, our new members that today when we go over stuff, to the extent that we need to backtrack to explain stuff, you guys are CEOs, you probably know all this stuff. I know for me as a judge, I don't always get it. Cheryl, so if you need something, we can give you some background.
I appreciate that.
And I know that you came from the crack of dawn this morning. Bonnie came from the crack of dawn this morning, or last night, but a three-hour drive. You just got to drive over the bridge.
To be fair to me, though, my courthouse just lost power, and so I've been sort of dealing with that.
Okay, all right. So as long as you
think. Just drive it over.
Okay, as long as you suffered a little. All right. Okay, go ahead and take roll.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to start by taking the roll committee members. Judge Oxney.
Here.
Judge Bremer.
Present.
Judge Heinrichs.
Here.
Judge Pace.
Here.
Judge Rockwell from Sacramento will be joining at about 10:30. Judge Wong.
Here.
Sherry Carter. Ms. Sherry Carter.
Here.
Mr. Kim.
Here.
Mr. Matroika.
Matroika,
sorry.
Okay.
Ms. Morton. Sharon Morton? Not quite yet. Okay, Mr. Planet?
Here.
Ms. Sloan?
Here.
And Mr. Taylor?
Here.
Thank you. That concludes the roll. And then on the staff side, it's myself, Leah Rose Goodwin, Office of Court Research, Chris Bololi?
Here.
Kristen Greenaway? Yvette Hong?
Here.
Lucy Fogarty?
Yeah.
And Rose Butler? Not quite back. There she is. Okay.
And Zlatko Theodorovich.
Terrific. Thank you.
All right, the first thing we're going to do is get approval from the minutes of the last meeting. Do I have a motion?
No approval.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and approve the minutes by unanimous. We need to... We're kind of early for this public comment.
Well, I'll mention that there was only one public comment, and it was specific to an item on the agenda, so we're going to hold that for a few until 10:30 when Judge Rockwell can join. The comment came from Sacramento Superior Court. So the proposal is that we take an item out of sequence, and that would be the informational item.
Judge Heinrichs, are you ready to give that on the spot like that?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
So this is about the AB 1068 subcommittee, and I am one of the representatives from this committee on that committee. It is the Sanju committee, and it is the Trump Court President Advisory Committee. And we've been meeting and found that there's a lot that we need to know, and so we formed subcommittees, or not subcommittees, specialized units of commissioners and family law facilitators to try to identify what they do so that we could be looking at it. Some of the concerns obviously are twofold. One is the self-help monies that flow to counties as part of the AB 1058 grant, and the other is the commissioner money as well. And so actually at our last meeting, from a presentation from the trial court budget advisory folks that are on the committee, we sort of decided to take a step back and do some more fundamental groundwork, sort of what's the purpose, how, what are the needs, and so we're really going to put together some long meetings to go through kind of what small courts need, what medium-sized courts need, what large courts need, and try to reach some compromise in the room before maximize the money we get. The issues are kind of complicated because everybody says we need more money, but every year we need money on the table. And so it's hard to make justify that you need more money if you don't spend the money that you already have. So it's really real to step back and take a more systematic approach. And so that's what we're doing.
All right. And when is the committee going to meet again?
So we have two all-day meetings scheduled. They're in the process of being scheduled. They're out to Google. I think they've been finalized, but they're coming up soon.
Okay.
Mid-March, early, I think is what they're looking at.
All right. Thank you. Anybody have any questions about this 1058 issue? All right, did somebody else join on the telephone?
Yes, this is Sharon. I'm sorry I'm late.
Oh, no problem. We just got started. Thank you for joining us.
Okay.
All right. No, I think we'll go to, We're still ahead of schedule because Judge Rockwell can't be on the phone until 10:30. So do you want to do the presentation from Sabet?
Yeah, I think if we could, we'll start with item one, which is our discussion of infractions workload. In terms of the, I think it sort of sets the table for item two, which is the item that Judge Rockwell wants to talk about.
Okay, and if we have to interrupt it, if we're not done.
Then we can do that.
We can
yeah,
do. Okay.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. So just to recap for those who might be on the phone, we're then going to take item one, and you have in your materials packet there are two things. There's a memo to the committee that starts on page 6, and we also sent out yesterday a PDF file with the slides that correspond to this item, and the document title is item 1. And I'm going to introduce Sivette Hong from the Office of Court Research.
Thank you, Leah. So the true infraction case weight was initially established with the RAS study in 2011, and what was observed at the time was that there were different processes in place in large courts and small courts. So in large courts, we had economy of scales, technology, and resources that allow the courts to process infraction cases much more quickly than smaller courts. So in order not to penalize smaller courts, for not being able to realize the economy of scale that larger courts had, the committee at the time approved the use of two infraction case weight and with a cutoff point at around 100,000 filings. So courts who had 100,000 filings or more received a smaller infraction case weight, and those who had filings below 100,000 received the larger infraction case weight. And so what we see in this graph is, it's also in your packet, at the bottom of the graph is the 58 counties. On the y-axis, we have the filing counts. And the horizontal line that you see going across is at the 100,000 filings. So cluster 1 and cluster 2, and the dashed line, it's 20% within the 100,000 filings. So the bottom one is 80,000. The top one is 120,000.
So that I'm just going to say for reference, it's in your packet on page 10. You want to take a look at it, but it goes the other direction.
Yeah.
That's thank you.
So what we see in this is that cluster 1, cluster 2 courts, in general, their filings, three-year average filing, is well below the 80,000 mark. And cluster 4 courts, their filing is well above 120,000. It's cluster 3 courts who are hovering near that margin. So when the two-weight model was developed, there was not considered that there was a potential of courts actually crossing over that threshold, that 100,000 filing threshold. But with the recent decline in infraction filings, there is that potential that court will cross that boundary, and it has actually occurred. And so what we see in this table is that courts, so this is a table of all cluster 3 courts who are hovering near the 100,000 filings. What we see is when WAFM was first implemented in fiscal year 2013-14, we had 5 courts in Cluster 3 who were above the 100,000 filing marks, and everyone else was below. And in subsequent years, as filing continued to decline, we had Contra Costa and Fresno who actually crossed the 100,000 filing marks. They went below it at some point in time. We had Kern, San Mateo, and Ventura who are getting near that boundary. Within the next few years, as filing continues to decline, they will cross the 100,000 filing boundary. So what does that mean? So if we take a look at this example, if a court originally had well above 100,000 filings, they had received the lower infraction case weights. And the moment the filing drops below 100,000 filings, they end up getting the larger infraction case weight, which then increases the FTE needs dramatically. However, given a court who were originally considered to be a large court who had the economy of scale, the technology and resources, when their filings were well above 100,000 filings, they don't automatically lose all that the moment their filing just drops underneath 100,000 filings. So which then questions, is it warranted that there's an additional FTE need for that court? So to address this issue, we're proposing 3 recommendations for this committee to consider for deliberation. The first recommendation is to task the staff to do a technology assessment of the courts in California. So what's happening is that we want to do an assessment of the assumption that is built into the 2 weight model for infraction, where the assumption is that there are technological and resources differences between large courts and small courts. And given that decline in infraction filings and the shortfall in funding over the past several years, many courts have adapted to the situations by either migrating off legacy systems, adapting new processes, adopting technologies to help them with case processing. So doing an assessment on what technologies are out there, what courts are utilizing recently to help them with the case processing will then help understand if the assumption is still warranted. Do we still need a 2-infraction case weight? And if so, do we need to differentiate a new cutoff point saying who can have the lower infraction case weight, who has the higher infraction case weight? Or do we then do a different cutoff point or classification of, is it going to be based on who has technology to help with infractions or who doesn't? Or if everyone has technology to help them and other resources to help them process cases, then maybe we get rid of the 2-infraction case weight and consider just 1-infraction case weight. The second recommendation is that we wait for the Futures Commission's work on their recommendations on the civil adjudication of minor traffic cases. Right now, that committee is doing an evaluation of what kind of minor vehicle code infraction cases get migrated over to civil and which ones stay. Also, there is a pilot program that's going into effect coming fiscal year 2018-19 where they're doing an assessment on individuals' ability to pay as well as doing online adjudications of traffic cases. And if the committee, the Futures Commission decide, we like the result, we're going to move forward and we should recommend the council to implement this in all 58 courts, this will completely affect infractions and how we calculate the case weight for infraction. With the third recommendation, because recommendation 1 and 2 will take quite a bit of time to conduct, it'll take either months or years. And so with recommendation 2, we're proposing an intermediary adjustment by fixing the eligibility of who's able to get the smaller infraction case weight based on a particular point in time. This could be with the initial law firm year of 2013-14 or some later point in time. If you were eligible at this point in time for the small infraction case weight, you maintain that status moving forward until this committee decides otherwise. So,
want to open that up for discussion? Sherry, did you want to weigh in on this?
Thank you very much. I really appreciate all the work you put into this, and I strongly support that we not allow a drop in filings to actually result in additional funding under WAFM. That was clearly something that we did not anticipate at the time we voted on having these two different weights for infractions. I still support the larger number of minutes for those smaller courts that may not achieve as much efficiencies as the larger courts. And I would actually be willing to propose a motion that that wherever you were in, I think you mentioned 2013, is where the court should remain, even if their filings drop, until such time as you have the ability to reassess the level of automation and perhaps do a remeasurement. I think that would be the fairest way to do it, because those smaller courts who were manually processing those citations would continue to get the higher credit until this new measurement is done, but it would not give a windfall of money to the courts whose filings actually dropped.
Mike?
A question. Do we know of any small courts that are actually using technology? Either they're scanning in their tickets or they're able to electronically interface with the case management system? Are we just assuming that there are just medium and big-sized courts?
There are small courts that are doing that. Mine is not one of them, unfortunately, but I know there are. YOLO has their tickets scanned in, data entry, and automatically initiates cases in their case management system.
Yeah. So that's my point. Is it's not just a function necessarily of the number of filings, but it's who's taking advantage, who is able to use what technologies. That's why I think the survey would be useful.
So, Mike, you're saying that use a survey and those courts that have now integrated technology would then go to the lower minutes. And I'm okay with that, too. I just don't want to harm those smaller courts that are still manual. Originally, I had thought, well, gosh, let's just take the average during the period that the Judicial Council staff does a reevaluation, but that seems to harm those smaller courts that are still manual. So however we can do it, that would give those smaller courts that are manual the higher minutes. I am strongly in favor of not allowing courts that have a drop in filings end up with more money under WAFM.
Yeah, having said that, I would second the motion because I agree. I think there's so much that's going to be in flux over the next 2 to 3 years. And I know from firsthand experience because we're involved in the ability to pay pilot project and with commenting and being asked to comment on the new legislation pilot project. And then we've got the civil, the whole civil, which may actually end up creating more work, as might the ability to pay. So, I would support and second Sherry's motion just because it's going to be, we'll be here every year changing something for the next 5 years. And, the stability is kind of one of the goals that we were shooting for in the Budget Advisory Committee, and I think the same principle would hold for us. So I support and I'd second Sherry's motion.
All right. Anybody want to comment on the motion on the floor?
I would. I agree with it. It seems like that's recommendation number 3, but rather than reassessing and utilizing surveys to see what the numbers change is, shouldn't we wait for the Futures Commission to make a recommendation, and then at that point we can either do a survey to see what the number changes have happened in the various counties?
Well, the Futures Commission has made their recommendation. It's whether or not after the pilot they decide to go forward with it.
And that's 2008, well, this year and next year for their evaluation.
Anybody else?
My recollection from 2012 was that it was pretty much just a purely arbitrary decision. We could have just had cluster four cores is going to be higher too. Other cluster is going to hire one. One thing I do remember clearly was the graph. I think it was presented actually probably in this room. Up there on the screen, it plotted the number of filings against the case weight from that time study. And it was just kind of a shot. It was, nobody could see any pattern.
Judge, I'm sorry, but we cannot hear that conversation at all on the phone. So if you could repeat it, that would be great.
And right. Since there's the quick interruption, this is Judge Rockwell. I'm calling in for about 20 minutes.
Okay.
So my apologies for the interruption.
All right, we'll come right back to you, Judge Rockwell, but I want to go ahead and have that comment that was just stated, restated, so that everyone can hear it.
Yeah, I'll back up to the beginning. I just said in 2012, it was pretty much an arbitrary just to –
Yeah, we still can't hear. I'm sorry.
Is that microphone live? Huh, I don't know. Michael, why don't you start by introducing yourself, and then maybe you can come back here and then make your comments.
Sure. I think that one's connected to the recording. You want to come up this way?
Sorry.
Kind of. And you're here with Judge Wong, correctly?
Right. Michael Courier, sir.
I know.
Okay, thank you.
Fine.
Good afternoon. Bring over the table. No, essentially, the gist of my comment was just harkening back to 2012 when we were doing, or 2011, 2012, whenever we had the meeting at the end of that time study for RAS 2. My recollection at the time was that it was just an arbitrary decision that we didn't. We could just as well have said cluster four gets one case weight and the other clusters get another one. That was kind of the gist of what we were aiming for. There was a graph that was displayed during that meeting that plotted the number of filings versus the case weight from that time study, and it was just all over the map. There was we kind of puzzled over it. I recall pretty clearly that we couldn't really see what the pattern was of why some courts had lots of filings had a higher case weight, some had a lower filings had a lower case weight. It really suggested there were a lot of complex reasons for why, that it wasn't just technology, there could be other things, there could be local impacts, there could be all sorts of reasons at play. So I think it's a fairly complicated issue here. That a survey might be useful, but in the meantime, I'm not sure what we could accomplish of making a change at this time, maybe just saying something, and then if we want to divide it that way. I think that was the effect of why we set the 100,000, was it created that boundary between those courts.
Any other comments? You're probably going to have to get the mic.
Well, this is Deb Heiner. Sherry, can you hear me?
Barely, but.
Well, I support the motion, and the reason why is that it simply does prevent courts that have a reduction in filing to actually get more money when they cross over that line, and that's really sort of a stopgap while we look at other things. So I support that motion because it prevents that from occurring, which was an unplanned result.
All right, any other discussion? Come back.
Back up.
Yes.
Just one question I guess to consider, though, is we'll count the other way. If a smaller court increases in filings above 100,000, are we freezing it versus are we?
Well, that means they lose money. So
they
go above
it. Right, but are we going to let them lose money? Depending on which approach is taken, it's whether we freeze it at the 14 level or to say if you dip below it, you don't. I mean, we're going to be freezing.
In my mind, we're seeing everybody drop, and so I think address it if it goes the other way. But I think that what we're seeing now is more drop than when they're at that zone. It makes a significant difference to the WAPA calculation. So, I mean, I suppose you could say the other, but that's not realistically what's happening. So, it's sort of a. I mean, I think the issue then, hopefully, the studies would be done because those courts may have been having. In reality, there are small courts that may have technology that are benefiting from just the numbers, and that's why the study, a more in-depth study, is needed. But it wasn't ever meant that if you lose filings, you actually get more
Any other discussion? All right, we'll take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
What time? The motion on the floor is to fix the time in a certain time when 2013-14, when any court that was above the 100,000 threshold would remain at that case weight, and until such future time as this committee changes it and or the Futures Commission changes the way we look at infractions.
Okay.
And so that is the motion.
That's
that was
the motion on this.
By Sherry. And seconded by Mike Planet. Discussion was had, and we're taking a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none? Passes. All right, I want to jump now to Judge Rockwell for her public comment. I know we only have you for a limited time, and thank you for – we're sorry you're not here, but we're glad you're able to join us for a few.
And I do really want to thank everybody for letting me do this and letting me do this out of order. So I do apologize for any inconvenience. It's one of those situations where I just moved courts. So my scheduling didn't quite make it onto all of the master calendars in the new building. So my apologies for that. But once I got handed the trial, well, here I am. The issue that folks might remember is at the last meeting there was and I think I had largely been the only one to have raised it, was the concern with regards to the complex civil and in part the way we're doing it. And at the time there had been a very generous offer to maybe reach out to other courts to see if there was something that they were seeing that might be similar. And my request had been, instead of just relying on what may very well be my own idiosyncratic background and what I was as a lawyer here, shade things, that I would actually go back to Sacramento CEO and ask if we're seeing an undercount with regards to our complex cases because of how we're doing that count electronically. And when I went back, it does turn out, and I know that these numbers are going to sound like not even budget dust for counties like LA. But for us, it's about 10% of our complex cases aren't being counted under the current system. And we think it might be slightly higher. And part of it is we're going to readjust the way we're doing things. But we did have about 10% of what we would consider to be complex cases not getting picked up because they don't pay a fee. We've got some that are pro pers. I even heard about another one that's just coming down where we get private attorney general cases, and that doesn't apparently, for whatever reason, hit the complex filing fee. But there's one case, for example, that's being handled by a next-door neighbor of mine, and it's got 31 defendants. 31 plaintiffs, many, many defendants, and it's coming in as a wage and hour private attorney general case. So complex, but not getting picked up when we just look at the filing fees. So the request from here would just be that we could do a manual count to try and pick up some of those things so that when we do get fee waivers from our public agencies or others or simply don't pay fees, that we could still count them in our numbers. But I do understand on that what might be easy for Sacramento would be a huge, huge time sink for a county like LA.
All right. Thank you, Judge Rockwell. I know that you wanted to make two public comments. So do you want to make the other one? Because I don't want you to run out of time before you have to go.
Let me read my back. No, I've lost my notes. I'm sorry. I just got off the there we go. Nope, that's the wrong. I'm sorry. I'm trying to switch to electronic. So then the next one really just goes to the work year values. And I understand that we've had a tradition. I guess partly this was just prompted by the fact that So I do come from the Department of Finance and how the state calculates PYs appears to vary somewhat dramatically with how the courts do PYs. So I'm not quite sure.
Define what a PY is for.
Oh, I'm sorry. So it's how many hours you would consider to have work from a given employee. So you count up. So instead of counting necessarily positions, you would count the number of hours, because that way you don't have two part-time people being considered two personnel years. You would have it being considered one personnel year being filled by two people. So it's one of the ways that the state tries to look at how many person years a given task or a given department needs versus necessarily the number of bodies that complete that. Because sometimes for some people, especially if you take a look at the taxing entities, they have a large number of seasonal workers. They don't need that person all year, but you count up their hours to figure out how many PYs the department might need to be funded for. And here, and partly I think it's just that I'm new and I just don't know where it came from, we see that the Judicial Council has adopted a much higher PY, so a much larger number of hours that we assume that someone is going to work than does the state. So we weren't quite sure why we're doing that, but we do think that that creates sort of almost a lowballing, and not in a bad way, just we're expecting to get far more hours out of any one person than the state expects to get out of their people. And we're presuming that a one PY can do more hours of work. So we wanted to raise that as sort of a branch issue as to why that is. And in part, it's our assistant CEO also comes from both finance and the Department of Justice and the Comptroller's Office. So it was something that popped out to him as he was just going through and coming up to speed with how the courts operate.
All right. Thank you very much, Judge Rockwell, for that public comment.
Sure.
The where we were in the agenda is back to item two, to discuss the updated RAS for the 2018-2019 allocation. Savette?
Thank you. So what we provided in your packet is the RAS 3-year filing that is being used for the RAS updates. So our annual updates, we generally update the 3-year filings. But this year, it's a little bit different than previous years because we're also making additional updates that the committee and the Judicial Council has approved last year. This includes the case weights using the most recent RAS study case weights, as well as the Department of Finance work year value, updating the manager-supervisor ratio, as well as the program 90 ratio. All these updates have been entered, and to generate the RAS FTE allocation for fiscal year 2018-19. So this is without the modification that you guys just approved for the fraction.
Which page is this? 22. 14 on 22. 22 in the materials. The document that's on the screen right now corresponds to page 22 of the packet. And right before that, there are several pages which include the filing data.
So we need this committee to review and approve the RAS FTE allocations before it can move on to tick back for funding allocation.
And Savette, did you say this does or does not?
Does not include what we just voted on. If we incorporate what we just voted on, Contra Costa will lose 16 FTE and Fresno will lose 12 FTE.
Nobody else will change.
Nobody else will change.
So I think what we'd be asking for is a discussion of this item and if it's recommended approval, this recommended approval with those two changes noted so that we don't have to come back to the committee.
So, Leah, I think you just said if we consider this, we consider it with what we just voted on. Is that what you said? Very hard to hear.
Sorry about that, yes. Yes, that's what I was saying, Sherry.
And,
okay.
And Tibet gave us the FTEs that would change for both Contra Costa and Fresno, and it was
16 for Contra Costa and 12 for Fresno.
Yeah, and I'm just going to say this. I think it should not be related to individual county-specific issues. We're really talking about policy. And so, you know, I certainly support the new numbers, and I support them with the decision we just made because I think that's the right policy decision. And so whenever the time's appropriate, I will either vote to support someone else's motion or I'm happy to make it. I think that the numbers are the numbers.
I make a motion that we approve these, incorporating
the earlier
vote we just took.
All right. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All right. Hearing no discussion, can I have all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, it passes unanimously.
I do have a request related to Judge Rockwell's comments because we, about the personnel year, could we get in writing from the state what their personnel year is? Because we voted on that based upon indication that that was the figure that the state used, and now we have information that that's not the correct figure. So for a future meeting, I would like to know what the state actually.
I think that's a good approach. Anybody have any opinion about that, about not doing that?
I couldn't hear it. I could tell it was Brian's voice, but I didn't hear what he said.
What Brian said is now that we have information from Judge Rockwell, who is a committee member who brought in during public comment but could have brought it up just regularly in the committee, that she questions the use of the Department of our use of the staffed year value. That we would like some further clarification from the state.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if there's two different numbers that they're talking about. Because the person year, I don't think, is what we were contemplating as part of this calculation. I think what we're looking at is the actual number of hours, right?
Yeah.
They were.
Minus 2 weeks vacation, and you get the whole thing. I think it's a different calculation for a different purpose.
Yeah.
Hi, and this is Judge Rockwell. Oh, I'm sorry, was that Slotko?
It was, but go ahead, Judge.
Oh, no, I will certainly defer to Slotko on this.
The full-time equivalent concept, PUI personnel year, is still the same. You know, how much time does a position have in a year to do work? And obviously, when we look at the minutes and the conversion of the filings to minutes and then how that turns into FTEs, the state doesn't use minutes. The state uses hours. And I think that this issue is the leave usage, be it sick and vacation. And so I've reached out to the Department of Finance to get sort of more confirmation about what their value is. Let it be known that there are some sort of variations, and it is, again, based on the idea of the number of leave days that an employee takes. So we are in the process of doing that, which Brian has suggested that we get from them. But it's not from my days, it was not a written formal policy. In fact, it sometimes varied from a Department of Finance unit to unit as to what they use as the reasonability test for a staff need. So that is in process, and we will report back to you what we conclude from the Department of Finance's review of the values. We were under the impression that the staff had done that confirmation, and so that was the basis of the numbers that are used in RAS now, but we want to double check and make sure that we are using the right values for the model.
Mike, you want to say?
You know, we took the action, and it was a very painful action because our studies had indicated that our value was 1595, which was a
lower value given the leave balances and the longevity of the people we have. And it was a painful decision because the goal was to align ourselves closely with state practice.
Right.
Get you off the table as we were trying to really get QAFM accepted and validated and used as a means of defining needs. So if that state number is different, you know, if the 1776 is the correct number, that actually benefits us in that sense. But I think the overall goal was to align ourselves, and if that information has changed, we ought to know it. But let's remember why we took that very painful action, which all it did was reduce the number of staff that we were needing in order to fully fund the courts.
And that's what we're in the middle of, is ensuring that we have better confirmation from the Department of Finance and the value from their staff.
And this is Judge Rockwell again. And again, I really don't have the history, and I would not have had this go through with the letter if there had been any way I couldn't make it to this meeting, because I understand this is kind of a kludgy way to go forward. We just wanted to raise it. But we did not mean to imply, and I certainly did not mean to imply anything that I know we made really hard and painful choices in the past. So we just wanted to raise it.
All right. May I ask what the next step is? If LACO does reach out and we do find there is a different number, will it be automatically applied to align us with the other state, you know, with the executive branch, as Mike pointed out, or will we need to have a conference call to make that recommendation, or what will happen?
Sherry, this is Judge Oxney. I would think that we would want to have a conference call and to discuss that and vote on it.
Okay.
But we could do that, you know, in a moment's notice if it actually turned out to be that way.
Great.
All right. I guess we're ready to move on to information number two. Chris, are you ready?
Yeah, thank you. Maybe we can move that.
Just for a sound check, can people on the phone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, as most of you should know, the filings data used in the workload models, both RAS and the judicial workload study, comes from GPSIS. And so what I thought I would start with is a little background or some kind of a refresher about what GPSIS is. I see some GPSIS experts in the room, but it might be a new area for some people. GPSIS is the statistical reporting system that courts use to report all their court operational data. It's not just filings data, but it's data on the type of disposition, time to disposition data for certain case types, as well as sort of event level data such as the number of hearings, motions, et cetera. It's also sort of the series of definitions and reporting rules that really govern how courts should report their data and where it should go. And I think that second piece is really critical because courts sort of operate their own case management systems locally. We have sort of a decentralized case management system here in California. And what those rules do is sort of ensure from all these different systems, all the different codes that might be used in those systems, that we get sort of comparable and consistent data across the courts. And so that's sort of the really the important piece of GPSIS that was really the focus of these revisions. GPSIS is also sort of the statewide data warehouse. All of the filings data, as well as all the other data reported by courts, goes into this single sort of statewide repository, and that's where we pull the filings data that we use for the RAS updates that Savette shared, as well as for the judicial workload study, and for things like the court statistics report that we publish on an annual basis. You'll see sort of later on sort of mention of GPSIS and the portal, and I wanted to sort of share that there's sort of two different versions of GPSIS out there. The sort of the full version of GPSIS is really a lot more comprehensive data, a lot more detailed data that's reported by courts that have automated their case management systems to report this more detailed data directly from the system. When GPSIS was created, it was sort of recognized that not all courts would be able to make that transition right away. There was a lot of legacy systems out there. And so there's sort of a higher level, more aggregate data that some courts report using what's called a web portal. And so those courts go on to a website, report filings and dispositions, many of the data that's used for our workload models, but a lot of times in more aggregate categories. And when I show some of the GPSIS changes that came out of SEAC, you'll sort of see a little bit of what I mean about GPSIS case types versus portal case types. GPSIS was created by, or the authorization for GPSIS was sort of created through rule of court by the Judicial Council, Rule 10.400. And then the council then sort of delegated authority to SEAC, or the Court Executive Advisory Committee. So SEAC is sort of the advisory body that has oversight responsibility over GPSIS, much like this group, WAC, has oversight over the workload models. And that's sort of important because for those that have been part of this committee for a while, WAC actually came to SEAC, I think back in 2013, to recommend some changes or some additions to portal case types so that we would get filings data in all of the case types needed to support RAS. And so there's sort of a relationship here, and the fact that Office of Court Research sort of staffs or involves in both, I think, provides a good level of coordination between the work of SEAC over GPSIS as well as the work of this group. The Court Executive Advisory Committee, I think, recognize sort of the importance of the filings data in GPSIS, in part because of RAS and judicial workload model, but the fact that in WAFM, the data from these models were being used for budget allocation decisions. And so what SEAC decided was to create a working group to review a lot of those definitions or reporting rules in GPSIS to make sure that they were clear and as up-to-date as possible. GPSIS was created back in 1999, and there were a lot of areas in GPSIS that really hasn't gone through this level of review or updating. And so the SEAC created a working group, which is now called the GPSIS Subcommittee, to look at and just to focus on filings and case types, because these are really the two types of data or information in GPSIS that are really driving the workload models and driving the budget allocations that come out of WAFO. And the way that the working group and now the subcommittee approached this effort was to really go out to all the courts and to get the court sort of review and comment and feedback over all of the GPSIS definitions, reporting rules that are in the current version of GPSIS, try to get questions that they have, try to get areas that the courts feel needed to be updated, and the working group then took all of this feedback and all of this review, or the information from this review process, and came out with some proposed revised definitions in GPSIS that went to SEAC for their approval, and in January were presented to the council for formal sort of adoption. And I should just mention the subcommittee is made up by, I believe, seven different court execs, a couple in the room, Mike Planet and Mike Roddy. Sherry Carter on the phone is also a member. And so we really have a lot of expertise on the subcommittee, both in sort of GPSIS and court operations, as well as the importance of these rules and the data that comes in for purposes of the workload models as well as for funding decisions. So in terms of the changes that were made to GPSIS, I'd say maybe the vast majority or sort of a lot of these changes really focused on clarifying or updating the language and the definitions. Based upon all the comments, there were some ambiguity relating to how things should be counted or what the language and the definitions actually meant. And so what the working group really did was just to recraft or to revise some of the language in the manual that defines sort of what should be counted as a filing or what should be counted as a case type. One of the areas of focus was really getting back to the portal versus GPSIS is to ensuring that the definitions aligned between what the portals reported and the definitions that, or the rules that underlie the portal categories and what GPSIS courts report. They're also added sort of additional examples to these definitions to help courts understand sort of what should go into a particular category, as well as things like updated judicial counsel forms and things like that. But this is an area that really should not impact the data that comes in through these new revised GPSIS standards or the filing data that's used in the model. It's really just to sort of add some clarifying language to the existing categories or the existing definitions. One area that would impact the filings data that would come in, as well as the data that's used for the workload model, would be some areas where we, or the working group, revise sort of the counting rules for a particular category about what should be counted as a filing. One example that I'll get into, and we'll sort of make a deeper dive later, is DCSS, or the child support category, where the working group sort of made a change to not the category itself, but some of the rules that govern what should be counted in that category. So based upon some of these types of changes, what we might see is a slight increase or decrease in the number of filings that get reported in that existing category, but not a reformatting or this third category, which would be a brand new reporting category. And these would be changes that would certainly impact what gets reported and how this group should consider the data that comes in through GPSIS for the workload models. One area of this would be kind of like what I talked about before about the earlier changes to the portal. Some new reporting categories were added just to the portal in order to align better with the data that we get through GPSIS. But there were some new reporting categories or case types that were added to both GPSIS and the portal reports that will certainly give us sort of different data coming in, a new count of filings that will be part of the discussion that we'll have later in terms of policy considerations for this group. The effective date for these definitions will be July 1, 2018. So data beginning in fiscal year 18-19 will be based upon these new standards, but data that courts continue to report up through June 2018 or through the end of fiscal year 17-18 will still be based upon the current standards. What Savette sort of demonstrated or showed before in terms of the RAS FTE is based upon the filings data up through fiscal year 16-17. So when this group meets next year to review the next year's FTE numbers, that will be based upon data up through 17-18, so still based upon the old standards. So it will really be almost 2 years from now when the group will be meeting for the first time to look at what the data is for the based upon the new standards, but also based upon the old standards because of that three-year average, and that's some of the policy considerations that we're trying to anticipate and bring to this group so we can start planning for how we want to address the data that's going to be coming in with these new standards but still needing to incorporate or use the old standards. I have something down here for implementation date to be determined, and that's because just because we have a implementation date of July 1, 2018 does not mean that the courts or really us here at the Judicial Council will be ready to start reporting or receiving that data right away. There's a lot of work that will need to go into both on the court end and the council end, to incorporate these new standards both in the way that the case management systems are configured to report this new data, as well as what we have on our end, both in the data warehouse and in things like the GPSIS manual that sort of has all those rules that will reflect all these new standards. And in some ways, the good news is because of the time frame, we won't need this data right away for purposes of the workload studies. And so there can be a little bit of a delay or a little bit of a lag between the implementation date. And I think that's a good thing because I think both courts and the council will need that time both to get everything ready, but then also to go through that development and testing to ensure that the data that's coming in based upon these new standards is accurate and consistent across all the courts. Any questions so far?
Where do 827 petitions fall under the category? I know I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but getting to juvenile.
Those are the
records.
The records. There are certain types of matters that are not reported as filings. Clearly, when we do the workload studies, we capture that workload, but it's not an actual filing category. And the 827s would be one example of a type of matter that's considered more of a workload within an existing case, but is not based upon both the current standards and the new standards, not actually given a filing count in GPSIS.
So it's not counted?
It's counted within the GPSIS reports. It's not counted as a filing or used as a filing in the workload model, but the workload is measured when we go through and do the workload standards, and I see Mike as an expert on both ends.
Maybe another way to look at this is if you look at the old dependency and delinquency weights versus the new weights, you'll see that those weights are higher. That often is associated with new requirements like the 827 process, which adds time to a case. And so when we do the workload study, we capture all of those related activities within a filed case, and that's where you typically see those new requirements counted. Same with misdemeanors. You saw a dramatic change in the weights. That was probably associated with propositions. And so it might be instructive to go back over the old weights and the new weights so you can see where things moved. And that's where you'd capture a lot of that internal work.
Appreciate that.
And that's part of why the group updates the models on a regular basis is to account for changes in legislation and new workload that you would see when you did that pre and post on the workload.
Court execs are always concerned about capturing all the work.
Yeah,
me too.
I might just add to what Mike said. We tried to stick to the principle that if it was something that was filed in an action, already filed action, it didn't count as a new filing. And we ran across this as, we're dealing with
probation violation, family law, probation.
That's extra filing. Well, no, it's an action of a underlying case. So we tried to be, and I think we managed to stay consistent with that kind of principle throughout all cases. It wasn't easy.
So in terms of what the impact of these GPSIS changes are, and just in advance, if you can go ahead and refer to pages 23 to 34 in the materials, I think 23 will have Civil Limited up on the top. What we wanted to highlight is not those simple changes to the cleanup language that really is not going to impact the filings, is really those second two categories that I talked about, ones that might change the counting rules within an existing category, but then to also highlight certainly some of those new categories created, some for just portal, some for both GPSIS and portal, so that the group could sort of see a little bit of what these changes might mean in terms of the current way that the workload standards are structured. And I think what we also felt would be meaningful for the group is to see in those materials sort of the mapping or the association of the workload standards or categories in RAS, those categories in the judicial workload study, and I know Kristen and Savette will be talking about those, and you'll begin becoming more familiar with those. And what I have there is the old standards, and so that's certainly not the direction that we're necessarily going with the update. As well as sort of the underlying detail of the case types for both GPSIS and portal courts. And you could, and you'll see, and we'll see as we go through some of that different detail of GPSIS data elements or case types versus portal case types. And we'll talk about these later, but obviously a lot of these changes will have policy implications that we'll want to start discussing and start planning for. Some of these will impact the approach to the workload study that Savette and Kristen will talk about. Some of these will impact the current RAS standards, which are obviously based upon the old or the current standards. And so what we'll need to start thinking about is how do we want to plan for some of these new data? Do we want to create maybe some interim standards as a bridge until the group then updates the entire study like we do on a five-year basis, or consider some other way, a glide path in terms of dealing with old and new data? And that'll be something that we won't need to deal with obviously this year or even next year, but I guess it'll be 2020 if we're all still here, that group, and we will all need to start dealing with and planning ahead for how we want to plan for that. So I'm going to go ahead and turn to those materials, and what I'll do is sort of take you through at a high level, and certainly both now or at a later time, if there are any questions, we can kind of go through them. But I'm going to start here on page 23. That sort of has Civil Limited on top. And sort of as I mentioned, and each one of these pages will sort of take a different category or an area and sort of show the mapping in a similar way. We're on the sort of the left panel will show what the current workload standards are for both RAS and judicial workload. And as we'll see, sometimes they align one-to-one, like unlawful detainer here, and other times we'll see where RAS will have more detailed breakout and judicial workload will be more aggregate, and sometimes we'll see the other way around. And then again, that's sort of what we have now, and I know for the judicial workload study we'll be showing some maybe more detailed breakouts that might align a little bit more with the detailed breakouts that we had in the most recent RAS. And on the right panel, you'll see the case types that we currently collect in GPSIS, as well as the case types in the portal. And I think on the Civil Limited side, this is one that sort of illustrates sort of that greater detail of data that we get from GPSIS courts that we don't get as much from portal courts. And just one last point before I get down into the changes, that in the portal column where we see unlawful detainer, that's an example of one of the new case type categories that WAC recommended to SEAC and that we added, I think, back in 2013. So prior to that, portal courts did not break out unlawful detainer. We just had that data part of Civil Limited. And I think what WAC recognized is the importance of all the courts to break out that data. And so that case type is one that reflects WAC's recommendation to SEAC to make that change to GPSIS. So in terms of the changes on Civil Limited and Civil Unlimited, very sort of minor changes, and both of them sort of fall into that category of a slight change to the counting rule, but no fundamental changes or new categories to the case types in GPSIS or the portal. And so the change that was made that impacts both Civil Limited and Civil Unlimited has to do with how civil case coordination is counted. Just a brief sort of summary of that. The old way or the current way would have a court that receives a group of civil cases that have been coordinated would only receive a count of one for that entire group of civil cases that are coordinated and moved from a different court or county to their court. And what the working group decided is there should be a count for each underlying case that has been transferred from another court or county to the court receiving that group of coordinated cases. And so what we'll see in terms of this change is really sort of for the
mainly larger courts, I would guess. So the courts receiving these coordinated cases, a slight uptick in the number of civil cases. And because a civil coordination can happen in any one of these case types, what we could see is a slight increase across the board that might not be targeted to one specific type of case, but if cases were coordinated in employment or contract, then that would be the category that we might see a slight uptick. And probably more likely to see these on the civil unlimited side than on the civil limited side. But again, just something that we'll see a slight increase in the filings, but really probably won't have a dramatic impact for this group to consider in terms of the workload models. So then on page 24, I'll just briefly sort of highlight, this is sort of an example probably of the RAS being a little bit higher level, just a single civil unlimited case, and then the judicial workload side, a little bit more of a breakout. But again, sort of what the workload study, what we decide to collect may change based upon what's in here. But the only change on this side would really just be that civil coordination that I highlighted earlier. So the next page is family law, and I won't comment that much on the mapping on the top. It sort of has the same logic or same framework as I described before. But here we have a couple of changes that will impact the data that we get in. The first change has to do with the child support or the DCSS categories. And the current rule in GPSIS counts a DCSS child support filing not only if it's filed as an independent action, but we should get a filing count even if it's filed within an existing family law case. And as many of you sort of know, there could be a divorce or a marital case where a child support matter gets filed within that case. And normally the rules in GPSIS does not count subsequent petitions within a case. It only counts that initial petition or complaint. But DCSS is one of the sort of exceptions to the rule where GPSIS asks courts to report a filing for those DCSS matters even if they're filed within an existing child support case. But in terms of the work of the working group, what we found is in all courts, DCSS does not initiate these child support matters in the same way. Many times the DCSS will file that initial complaint. I think it's a family law 600 or maybe a 650. And those were sort of defined in the current definition. But we found that in other jurisdictions, DCSS would not file that initial complaint but file a notice of payment. That still would signal that DCSS was involved in a child support matter and that still should have a count. But the current definition was sort of too narrowly defined, and so certain courts felt like they should not count a filing because of the way that the definition was structured. And so what the working group decided was to expand the definition to include this other judicial counsel form and to make the rule more broadly that a filing should be counted anytime DCSS enters a case to enforce a child support matter. And we hope that this will get a little bit more consistent and comparable data across courts that we might not have had before. But we'll also probably see an uptick, again, in the DCSS filings that might come in for those courts that felt the previous definition was too restrictive and that it might not apply to how DCSS file matters in their court, that the definition might now get that comparable data. And the other thing that we did, and maybe this is something for Judge Heinrichs, is we coordinated with our counsel staff that supports the 1058 work, and I know that the workload models, just to do some research on these proposed changes to ensure that they didn't have some unintended consequence or adverse impact on the work that group was doing to look at the way that the current data is being used to fund the 1058 program. And in fact, we found that this change would actually help support their work and would provide sort of a better or more complete count of DCSS data than the way that GPSIS currently was counting things. And so it's sort of a win-win in that us getting a little bit more comparable and complete data across courts, and hopefully it'll be data that can be used by the 1058 program staff in their work in building a workload model based upon hopefully this DCSS filings data. So that was sort of one of the big changes that we made to family law. The other change is sort of a smaller change to family law adoptions. The current language had terminology that seemed to suggest that these were only adult adoptions. But what we wanted to add is expand that definition so that they would also include adoptions of adults, as well as adoptions of married minors, which both can happen on the family law report. These are separate adoptions than the adoptions that are reported on the dependency report, which would be adoptions of wards under court supervision. And I wouldn't expect this to have a dramatic change. I think this was one that many courts would probably interpret and report in here. But one of those examples of revised language to hopefully clarify that we might just see a small uptick in the data coming in. On the felony side, and for those following, we're on page 26. The change that we made here was in that third category where we added a case type to the portal for what's called miscellaneous criminal petitions. This is a case type that GPSIS courts currently report, and you can see that in the GPSIS column. Portal courts had currently lumped these in with felonies. And what the working group decided is that it was important that we get comparable data for this category for both GPSIS and portal courts, because what it could allow this committee to do is to consider creating a potential new workload standard for these miscellaneous criminal petitions. Because they were lumped in with felonies for portal courts, we didn't have the data to look at the workload implications for what's a normal felony versus what's a miscellaneous petition. And these petitions are things like a petition to seal an arrest record or removal for a gang injunction. That certainly wouldn't involve a similar amount of workload as a typical felony case, but right now they're currently included in the workload standard and in the filing count for our felony standard. But by breaking them out, what we could start doing is looking at what is the workload differences between the two, and does it make sense, given the volume of these, and there's not that many of them, to consider creating a new or different workload standard for these that would more accurately represent the lower workload for these versus a regular felony.
Would that capture like all the new petitions we get when we get a new proposition?
Because
that happens, you know, every big election cycle.
They could. We defined this broadly with some examples, certainly not a complete exhaustive list. The way that the definition for these work is that they should not represent a petition filed within an existing case, and that gets a little bit at the 827s, where many times those are filed within an existing case. So these would be, you'd only get a filing count if this petition, or an example like what you're talking about, is a petition where there's no existing criminal case in which that petition would be filed. So if you have to create a brand new case number because this is a brand new matter, then that would be something that would qualify. And one of the things that the working group is setting up is a process where we're going to be reviewing and revising these definitions on a regular basis, in part based upon the questions that we get in from courts when new propositions and new things happen. So that's the implication here. And the other option is we don't need to make a change. We just continue counting them the way that we do. We continue mapping them into our felony standard. But it gives us the option of potentially breaking them out in a different sort of way.
So if we were to assign a new case number to a matter, one of the things that's come up is in our county, which we anticipate is litigation having to do with old files that go back 20, 30 years. We don't have the case. We may have the case numbers for them, but they have to do with enhancements if as part of a three strikes case, that sort of thing.
Sure.
We have to address those issues based on what's been presented to us. This would fall under that, or it would fall under the felony designation for the old cases? Because those cases go back 20, 30, 40 years.
I think it would fall under the existing felony case, and there are times that are more driven by court procedures or by legal requirements to keep a matter confidential that a court might need to create a separate case number or want to create a separate case number, and that alone should not drive the counting of a filing. There are sort of general rules about that as well. So, and I see Mike, and Mike's
being on the committee when we were discussing it, about a court,
yeah,
have a process where when they get these miscellaneous cases that are not connected,
yeah,
we create a dummy number, and we actually keep a manual index of these things. We have to have a way of tracking them, and we felt that it's a time to basically identify those, separate those out, and determine through this committee whether they need to have a new and separate case weight, or do we continue reporting them under the old felony category. And there were a couple of adjustments like that where we said, I don't think we're really capturing the impact. Let's get the data. It's probably going to take us a couple,
yeah,
of years. But it was workload that we weren't sure was being adequately captured and counted and credited. And I'm speaking on behalf of the committee at this point.
Mike, has there ever been any instances, I don't know if you guys ever talked about actually capturing what Judge Pace just said, the proposition work. Wouldn't that be kind of a powerful number to give to the legislature? Like, this is the felony case weight, but every time you change a proposition,
yes,
we have this. And I know you captured in the workload, but I just wonder if it wouldn't be.
See, I think what's interesting is if you could, if it was in isolation to any other change, I think you could readily determine the impact. But I think at the same time you've got new laws, new requirements, new statutes, and then, gee, by the way, there's a proposition. All of those things could affect a case weight. So if you could do a really scientific survey, you'd isolate the effect of the proposition, not change any other condition, and then do the before and after. I don't think we live in that world. So what we generally have said, and I know we've made this point in information to the legislature, is, you know, these did have an effect on workload. That's why you're seeing an adjustment in case weights, because they want to know, well, why did it go up? Well, it went up because of changes in the law and Prop 47, whatever that is.
And I think there'll always be a need to do ad hoc research and ad hoc data collection to answer these new questions that come up that may not be currently collected in a way that we could pull those out of GPSIS. So I think sort of that initial research oftentimes is done doing some ad hoc data collection and ad hoc research. And then if the working group and if SEAC then decides that there's enough there to monitor on a regular basis, I know because we have a subcommittee now, we're going to be looking at this on a regular basis. Those are changes that the subcommittee will be could review on a regular basis and incorporate in subsequent changes to GPSIS.
There is actually a third option as well, and kind of with Prop 47, which is that we will collect data on those petitions filed as it ties into that case funding that had been provided for a period of time. And of course, things became more complicated when they extended the time frame for that. But that is a third avenue that has been pursued and done for some while, mainly with our criminal justice group.
May I offer this, Judge Wong? One other thing I will just offer to the folks who are working on this. From time to time, it's in our county, for example, the executive branch and the legislative branch for the county may decide to fund different projects, which will affect the courts. No other county, but just our courts. For example, years ago, the late mayor decided to, and the legislature, the board of supervisors decided to fund a defense of an unlawful detainer unit. And what happened there was an increase in trials and other kinds of litigation related to unlawful detainers. Recently, and some of you as may know about the Humphrey case, which came down, but that came...
Some of us may know about that.
But that came as a result of a funding of $500,000 to the public defender's office and $500,000 basically to the DA's office to handle issues related to bail and release and so forth. What that did was it allowed the public defender's office to file without any without any limitation bail motions. They could file 2, 3, 4 of them in one case. It was limited to our jurisdiction, but now as a result of, you know, basically a one case, it's going to affect all counties in the state now as a result of that appeal. We don't know what's going to happen in appeal, but things like that happen. I just think that I realize it's ad hoc, but sometimes it just comes to us, and the litigation is monumental, because I did 200, 300, 400, I stopped counting, bail motions as a master calendar judge in a criminal division. And it put everything to a halt. It stopped all the usual customary motions and in-camera reviews and discovery proceedings and other things that we ordinarily would have judges available to do because we were engaged with this activity. I mean, we accept it, but it's just, significant impact on one particular county.
This is Sherry Carter. May I also make a comment related to that?
Sure.
Okay. So I agree with the comments that were just made, and I think that was a San Francisco judge, if I caught the...
Right, that's Judge Wong.
Oh, hi. And I agree with your comments. I think there's two things that we need to keep in mind. The first one is that these weights are directly related to staff time, not judicial time. And so I've had to remember that myself in Los Angeles because we have a huge impact on our judges and to a lesser degree staff because of the huge number of our UD cases that are going to jury trials. They are overloading our system. It is a major problem in LA County to get regular, you know, non-UD cases out to a jury trial. But then I have to remind myself that the weights that we're talking about are not judicial weights, they're staff weights. And so there is some impact because, of course, we have to summons more jurors, we have more jury work. There may be some changes to staff. But I think that we need to remember that the impact judges feel with a lot of those new laws and new requirements are part of the judicial needs assessment we'll talk about and not related to what we're talking about now, which is the staff-weighted work within a case.
Well, no, I disagree because I recognize that. I had the CEQA case for the Warriors Arena, the Golden State Warriors Arena, which had 13,000 documents and 160,000 pages that I personally had to review, and I realize that the case weights don't have anything to do with what I was doing. What I'm saying is that these have a direct impact on our employees and the time that is spent to deal with the files, the master calendar, and so forth. So it's just it's an issue that I think we need to be aware of. I'm not saying we have to do anything with regard to the full-time employee evaluations and assessments here, or the workload assessment. It's just something that's there that puts an incredible stress on our full-time employees.
Well, so my second comment is directly related to that, and it might be that we need to talk about it at a future meeting, because I do agree with you. I think there are extenuating circumstances that might be unique to a county that we might want to have a process, and we don't have time to talk about it today, and it's not been properly agenda placed on the agenda, you know, under the Brown Act and all that kind of stuff. But we might want to talk about a process where if we, and maybe there is one already, where if a county feels like there's a unique circumstance that should be considered differently, there should be a process where that could be evaluated and considered somehow. Because I agree with you, there might be things that are unique that need to be considered and possibly addressed. So I don't know if that's something, Leah, you think is possible, but I do agree with the judge that there may be unique circumstances in any county that might be a short-term or a long-term problem that are not addressed with the RAS measurements.
All right, thanks, Sherry. We'll go on to the next one.
So now since we're familiar a little bit with the issues, I'm going to, because we're getting into ones that have a little bit more changes, so I'll go through them a little bit more quickly, but again, if there are questions, we can sort of take these offline or off the group. And I think delinquency starts to get where we have this combination of new case types that are added to the portal, as well as a couple of brand new case types that we're collecting filings from for the very first time for both GPSIS and portal courts. And so the 777 matters were ones that had been reported only by GPSIS courts. Portal courts had not reported these as filings, and so because of that, we sort of excluded the filings data from the workload model. We measure that workload when we develop the workload standards, but an example of not having filings data from both GPSIS and portal courts. And so what we decided is to create a new category for portal courts for these 777 matters, much like we have for GPSIS. And so now we will have this data from all 58 courts with sort of three options. We could just continue to exclude them, knowing that we're measuring workload but just not counting the filings like we had done previously. We could decide to lump these into the delinquency standard, or much like on the criminal petitions, we could decide to study these and maybe create a new workload standard. The two other ones for non-minor dependent and miscellaneous juvenile petitions are brand new case types for both GPSIS and portal. And these are matters that the current rules did not define as a filing. So these were ones that courts had not been reporting as a filing both in either GPSIS or portal. But now we will have categories for these two types of cases and the ability to study the filings data from these categories, much like I've sort of defined before. We could decide to exclude them and just stick with the higher level the delinquency standard and category, or break these out in a slightly different way based upon this new data that we're having coming in. And just moving, I guess, somewhat quickly on the dependency side, sort of a parallel to the delinquency, where there are these matters, there are 387s that GPSIS courts had been reporting, but we had not been getting as filings from portal courts. So because we did not have comparable data from all the courts, we've always excluded that filings data from the models. But with the creation of a new category on the portal, we now have the ability to study these or to isolate the workload impact of these and to figure out what we want to do going forward. And then we also have these non-minor dependent as well on the dependency side. And clearly what we probably decide on the delinquency for these, we'll probably want to decide on the dependency or potentially treat them as a category, whether they're delinquency or dependency, and just look at them as a separate case type and take the filings data that we might get from either one. So on the misdemeanor and infraction side, a very small change. Parking appeals is going to be a new category on the portal. There's not that many of these. I don't see these really driving any of the filings data or really having impact, but I just wanted to highlight sort of a new category that portal courts will be reporting. Yes.
Just as it's maybe a newbie question, so the juvenile side looks like it's all mappings from the equal system portal. How on the criminal side do you deal with like data gaps and like granularity issues?
We sort of default to, I would say, almost like the lowest common denominator. So on the felony report, because the level of detail that we get from portal courts is only this aggregate felony category, oftentimes, and you'll see in our workload standards, you'll see in our research publications like the court statistics report, we will sort of publish, present, analyze data at that aggregate level. Yes, on the juvenile categories, there's a little bit more of a breakout and a little bit more of a one-to-one alignment, which allows us to study those for all 58 courts. But for ones where it's a little bit less granular for the portal courts, we oftentimes sort of roll up that detail we get from GIPSIS courts to align it to that aggregate data that we get from portal courts.
Is there a policy determination that sort of sets that alignment?
I
think
it's
a little bit interesting. Later in my presentation, but it's really, it is kind of the lowest coming. So, for example, we do not have a case weight for sexual assault because we can't get that data universally from all so it does some guide for what we can and can't measure. Just the data that we have is really the universal, it's the one source that we have.
Moving on to a new case management system in criminal, but then moving on in civil and in other areas later on. And so, as courts transition to new case management systems in a one department or in one sort of operational area, oftentimes we'll see them transition from portal to GIPSIS on felony and maybe misdemeanor and infraction, but maybe lag behind on the civil or family or juvenile areas because they're still using their legacy system. So, courts can be both GIPSIS and portal, and we see many courts that are, but courts that sort of make that transition to a new case management system sort of across the board, ultimately we'll be moving on to GIPSIS, and we know that most courts are moving on to new case management systems, and so that is something that we're excited about because that gives us that more granular data, hopefully not from all 58 courts, some of the big ones like Los Angeles and San Bernardino. That allow us to do that level of research. So, misdemeanor infraction, probate. Here is one where, and we're on page 30, two new portal categories for other probate. Before we made this change, and the current rules is portal courts report these other probate matters in a aggregate estates trust category. And in some ways, and that gets back to your question, James, that's sort of why we have for RAS a workload standard for estate, trust, and other, because portal courts, that's what they report. But now we'll have this breakout, not just for GIPSIS courts, but portal courts. And these other matters are really a lot more administrative. And probably don't have the level of workload that the estate and trust case would have. And so there's this opportunity for the workload models to get more refined and precise based upon this more detailed data. So those are two new categories there. And the last one is just something quick. The
this is one where I think we clarified language, but that might actually impact some of the data coming in. Some of the rules, and this sort of gets a little bit at portal definitions versus GPSIS definitions to, frankly, some language that was maybe not worded as clearly as it could about reporting temporary and subsequent and some of these competing definitions. And so the group decided, and this gets back again at that general rule about initial versus subsequent. Anything that said that initial petition on a case we report, but some of these other matters, we're measuring the workload, but they're not going to be reported as a filing. And so that's some cleanup language that we did on the probate side. Small claims and lower lower court appeals, I included them in here. There are really no substantive changes to GPSIS other than some language cleanup, but just wanted to, again, show you the level of data that we collect as well as some of the mappings of the categories of the workload standards in RAS and judicial workloads. Saving the best for last, or the most complex for last, and that's mental health. This is sort of a category that those familiar, those experts in GPSIS sort of know that this was sort of ripe for improvement and revision because of kind of the complexity of the area as well as the how detailed some of the categories are, and what the group I think identified is the need to consolidate instead of to expand. But what I needed to break out, because it was hard to fit on two tables, is sort of the current way and the new way. And so the current definitions are maybe a little bit like felony, where there's just an overall standard for mental health, much like there's an overall standard for felony. Portal courts, we sort of get this aggregate mental health category. There's sort of a catch-all other as well. And it's the GPSIS courts that break out, I think, 10 or 11 different types of cases. And there are these two at the bottom that are reporting categories for GPSIS, but they're not actually reported as filings. They sort of go into a different section of the GPSIS report. And I wanted to highlight that because it does relate a little bit to some of the impact of the changes that are going to be made, which is on the final page, or actually page 33, because it spills over into two pages. And that shows sort of what the new case types are, as well as some of those previous case types from the previous table. And what the working group, or now subcommittee, decided to do is let's keep some of our current categories, so those certifications and the LPS and the competency, as well as that other category, those are fine. Let's keep those. And, in fact, those are categories that GPSIS courts already break out, so sort of a one-to-one mapping between the current categories and these new categories, at least for GPSIS courts. But a consolidation of some of those other types of matters into these new higher level, more aggregate categories that we're terming civil commitment with an underlying criminal case and civil commitment without a criminal case. So we have these six categories in the new report that for portal courts will be an expanded list, for GPSIS courts will be in a more aggregate list. And then what also complicates it is that some we have a one-to-one mapping, so we could sort of look at the old data, at least for GPSIS courts, and see what it means or see what it looks like in the new categories. But for some of these other ones, we're sort of taking sort of these aggregate categories and trying to map them, but we can't really do that mapping for GPSIS. And so this is one that's going to really require a lot of study, I think, by the group. A lot of study by even us on the GPSIS team in terms of that testing and development to make sure the courts are reporting this. And I know that in the judicial workload presentation, you'll see that Savette and Kristen have already sort of anticipated some of this new data and trying to sort of reflect that a little bit in how we're collecting some of the data in the new model. And I have some of the specific changes down here below, and unless there's any questions about those, I can kind of maybe leave this a little bit and we can transition to some of the next slide, which is kind of the beginning of that policy discussion that I think Leah will sort of touch on a little bit and open it up to everyone. So last chance for mental health questions. Ready?
So just for scheduling purposes, we're going to stop at exactly at noon because Leah needs to be on a conference call. And so we'll have lunch at noon. So hang in there for another 16 minutes, and then we'll stop. And we will be working through lunch, but we'll take about 20 minutes, eat lunch, and then come back. And Leah will be back, and we'll finish. So we're a little bit ahead of schedule, but I know everyone's starting to look at the clock. So,
right. Thank you. Right, and we do want to allow for plenty of time for the discussion about the judicial needs study, so I'm kind of glad that we're moving a little bit ahead because this is it's an important opportunity for us to get feedback on some aspects of that study. So to transition between the two items, I just wanted to mention a few things related to Chris's work, and thank you very much for the detailed presentation. And for those who are on that committee, Mike and Mike, who are here, thank you for your hard work in getting the definitions aligned. This is a long overdue project.
I tried to get off. Mike wouldn't.
No, we wouldn't let that happen. So this is a bit of an orientation for our newer members as well, but I just want to, the reason why we feel it's important to go through the presentation and discuss the changes is that as we start to talk about the workload studies, the judicial study that we'll talk about this afternoon, and the discussions we'll have ongoing about the resource assessment study, or RAS, the filings data really guides and somewhat limits what we can measure. Filings data serves as our measure of workload volume, and I kind of relay in my mind, it's almost like the stream of workload that comes through the court. Is the volume high or low? And it doesn't, even though we use filings data, because filings are the most consistently reported and measured workload measure for the courts, it should not suggest that we are only measuring the workload associated with a new filing. And that's a really difficult principle for me to explain. But what I'm trying to say is that even though filings measures our volume of workload, we are measuring workload that may not be tied directly to that filing. So the example that might resonate the best is general customer service that happens at the counter. There are, in the course of a day, any number of individuals will come to the counter and ask for assistance from a counter clerk on something that may not relate directly to a specific new filing, but the counter clerk is still providing that service. When we do our workload studies, we are capturing that time that the clerk devotes to that matter, and we're portioning it out to all the weights that we use to measure the workload. So even though it's not, again, directly tied to a new matter that might be filed that day, we are still assessing that every filing that comes through the court has this body of associated workload that is also captured. And so as Chris has gone through the presentation, you'll see that there are some issues, there are some questions that the group will have to consider as to whether or not we pull them out separately and establish a different way to measure. So I think that felony issue is a good one. There's a new type of workload that's been identified related to miscellaneous criminal petition. It could be a matter that we fold in and absorb into the general felony workload measure case weight. It could be a measure that we establish a separate workload standard for. The principle that the group has used in the past for the past studies over the past several years has been what categories do we have the data? And where we have different case weights to measure different things, it's generally in recognition that there are clear differences in the staff or judicial resources needed for a particular case. So differentiating felony from misdemeanor and also from infractions is important because they all take very different amounts of workload. And the group may decide that we make further sub-differentiations or that we do the reverse and group things together as things change. Over the past 10 years or so that I've been working on this study, we've seen different matters sort of rise to the level of interest or importance. Parentage is a good example. Parentage has become more and more of a facet in family law cases, and so the last study, we developed a separate workload measure to measure the workload associated with that so that we could track that. And it's so now we disaggregate that family law category to measure that as well as other types of domestic issues. The for mental health specifically, and probably for juvenile, and I'm not sure which other ones, but we will probably see that the weights that we use right now to measure that workload will probably change pretty significantly when we do the next judicial and staff studies. If we're including new or different bodies of work, then the measures will be different. And so what we'll have to decide as a committee, again, we're doing the update to the judge study now, so we will be able to wrap up, or we're anticipating now any of those changes, and we're going to wrap those into the new weights. But when it comes to RAS, we'll have to keep an eye on whether or not we propose making an interim adjustment before the next time that we do the total study update, or if we hold the changes over for the next time that we update the models. This committee decided a few years ago that they would aspirationally update the two workload models every 5 years. And so our last update to RAS was approved by the council this last year in 2017, so we anticipate that the next update will get started on that for 2022. We are getting ready to do the judicial workload update. That's 2018. We had a bit of a lag time since the last update. The last time that study was updated was 2011. The priority had been on putting our resources to updating RAS, so we went that direction first. But it's important to update these models periodically so that we can capture any changes in the law, technology, case processing practices, make sure that our weights reflect the most current information available. So that will hopefully set the bridge over to our discussion this afternoon about judge workload. But I want to take this moment to just ask if there are any questions about this work. I guess the last thing I'll say is that I think Chris had alluded to that we have the definitions become effective this July, but we have some lag time before they will actually where we'll actually be using the filings data collected in our RAS models and also the allocation models. So the first time that it will hit the budget allocation process will be in our 2021 allocation. It is. Okay. Yeah, no, you're right. It feels so far away, but it feels also like tomorrow. So there will be this sort of walk. There will be a crosswalk process where we'll have a combination of both new and old definitions in effect with different sets of filings data, and we'll have to work out a plan on how we implement that, how the committee will choose to implement that. It may be that there are a couple of transition years where we use a combination of old and new definitions and old and new filings data based on the old and new definitions until we get to a point where we're fully or we have enough data for all 3 years. An alternative might be to ask courts to retroactively report their filings according to the new definitions, but that I could see that that might be more difficult for courts to do. And so, again, it's a little early in our process for us to have a good sense of which way might be the better way to go. We'll wait for a future meeting to discuss that. I'll turn it over now for questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
This is James again from Renee. I guess going maybe back to the earlier conversations about the consistency between GIPS and portal, have there been past sort of advisory committee or working group conversations on why there is a difference and why not move towards more drastically getting alignment between the GIPS and portal courts? The assumption right now is that we're doing that already, but we're doing that sort of in piecemeal. And so the burden that we're sort of assuming that the portal courts will have by adding these new sort of categories, they're going to have irrespective if you add additional categories. And I think I can frankly say that because I'm a portal court.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering why the shift in certain areas and why not the shift in others. Because like with felony, I could see a court where if
you're a portal court and you're on the felony and you have the criminal habeas, and now you have a miscellaneous, what would incentivize that court to actually say, hey, we actually have enough staff or resources now to count miscellaneous criminal versus before they didn't have to count miscellaneous criminal?
But this is from more our experience. Well, I mean, we do hear it from courts as well, both GPSIS and portal courts, as well as courts that make the oftentimes difficult transition between portal and GPSIS. And I think the same sort of constraints that for a portal court to make the full transition to GPSIS is sort of there in terms of expanding what they currently report. As I mentioned, sort of the GPSIS reports are not just filings. There's a lot more level of detail. And so you look at what portal courts report under a given case type, there might be six or seven different types of data, generally number of filings, certain types of dispositions, and maybe one hearing. GPSIS might have 50 or 60 different types. And oftentimes, it's that criteria or requirement that's probably more of a barrier for portal courts to report that level of detail than necessarily the ability to break out maybe more granular types of cases. And so, unfortunately, it's sort of we could and we certainly have expanded what portal courts report. Generally, it's not going down in terms of the types of data, but it's more across in terms of the types of cases. But my sense is portal courts are there because their systems don't allow them to report more granular data, and even making some of these transitions might be difficult, but we try to give them enough advance sort of warning and technical assistance to make that transition. I don't know if I answered your question, but.
Well, I think the concern of Marin would be, so if there are other studies being done on the granularity of the data and policy questions, it feels like from a court that's still on portal, your data may not be considered because the data is not there. It's sort of there in general. And so I guess the question I have is there ever a mapping over if a court is, let's say, submitting portal information and you're trying to come up with a policy question on RAS and you're looking at granular data, how are you going to some of the courts that are reporting portal data to actually map over this?
And I think the answer is we're not. So we're looking to the portal courts and saying, what can you do? And that's the level of detail that we'll take.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are sort of other types of requests. We work a lot with our Office of Governmental Affairs, and they're the gatekeepers of a lot of questions relating to, hey, do we have this type of data or that? And there are times when we might get a data request or some interest in looking at particular trends that might focus on a category that we only collect from GPSIS courts. And it does give us the opportunity to look at the 30 or 40 courts that we collect the GPSIS and try to extrapolate or estimate what the statewide totals would look like. But that is difficult because, you know, different courts might have different totals, and GPSIS doesn't include some of the larger courts, at least not right now, but I know LA is transitioning. It limits a little bit of what we do, not just on the workload side, but answering some of these other questions that come from OGA or from the public in terms of what's going on in the courts.
All right. With that, we'll go ahead and break for lunch. And when Leah gets back, we'll start the meeting again. I'm going to put the phone on mute during the lunch, and then we'll resume. I think we'll be resuming at about, let's say, 12:20, almost a half an hour from now. Thank you.
We're going to hang up the phones and change out the system, Sherry, if you're still on the call. And we'll zoom it with the new, we'll have to dial in again.
All right, Leah's back, and so we are going to get started on our final item today, the judicial workload. I did. Sherry, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Okay, is there anybody else on the phone? Thank you. We put in new phones for you, Sherry, so we hope that you can hear this.
Oh, thank you.
Now we can't hear her.
Okay.
Recording it?
It said it was. Well, I didn't do it when he first turned it on. It said that your meeting is now being recorded, and then I hit mute. So do we need to check? Okay, it did say that, though.
That means it recorded a half an hour of silence. So you'll need to
turn the microphone.
Right in front of you.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. Are we ready?
You should introduce yourself.
Yeah. All right. This is Kristen Greenaway. I'm a supervising analyst here in the Office of Court Research. So we are going to be talking about the judicial workload study. We have begun work on the study and wanted to take this opportunity to provide a brief overview of the study and then talk a little bit about the components of the study. And then before we get started, I just wanted to mention we are looking to form a small subgroup of this committee to be able to get feedback on some of the materials and documents that we will be using for the study. So as we go through this, I will kind of touch base on maybe some of those issues that we're looking for feedback on, and if there's interest and availability, we'd love to hear from you. All right. Okay, so just a little bit of an overview, and some of you are more familiar with this than others, but I just wanted to provide that kind of basic overview of a workload model. So the judicial workload study is a workload-based model. It's similar to the RAS, the staff workload model. But instead of measuring staff workload, we're measuring judicial workload. We do that by collecting data on time spent on different cases. So filings are the driver of these workload studies, but the time spent on those filings provides us a way to capture the workload that each of those filings represent. The study has been conducted twice in California, in 2001 and then again in 2011. And then in 2013, this committee recommended that the workload studies be updated every 5 years. So that's the point we're at now to begin work on the judicial workload study. All right, so why do we do these studies? So the studies allow us to develop a measure of judicial workload, so a way to assess judicial need and to estimate how many judicial officers are needed in the California trial courts to do their work. We also use the results of the judicial workload study to advocate for new judgeships, to advocate to the legislature. So in the past, we have secured 50 new judgeships for the California trial courts. And then also just to relate it to some of the workload, the RAS workload, we've used those results to advocate and secure funding for the trial courts. And so we've done these studies in the past. Why do we need to update the model? So we update the models because things change. Laws, processes, court practices, technologies. This is something we touched on earlier. And so these are things that can impact the time it takes to process a case, and therefore those case weights can change over time. And that being said, we don't want to overburden the courts with annual updates to these models. So we kind of decided that an appropriate schedule would be about 5-year updates to these models. So that's where we're at with kind of the quick overview of the workload models. All right, so now we just wanted to walk you through some of those key phases of the study and the timeline that we're looking at to conduct this study. So it's kind of organized in three main phases. We've got the first one, the development phase. That's the phase that we're in currently. So we're looking at in developing the instruments, testing those instruments, sampling, figuring out who is best to participate in the study, and then recruitment of those courts to participate. We will then move, and so that will take us through probably March of this year, so right around the corner. Then we will move to the pilot phase. So we are looking to conduct a two-court pilot study before we get into the main study. The pilot study will allow us to test the instruments, and that's kind of the main purpose of doing the pilot study, and then just to make sure the materials and everything that we have adequately assist in doing the study and support the work that's being done. We are looking to conduct those pilot studies in late May and in late April and then May of this year. We do have one court that's agreed to participate, and then we're seeking the participation of an additional court. Then we will move on to the summer months will be used primarily to make adjustments. So anything that we've learned from the pilot court, anything that we've learned from if we're able to get feedback from this group to make adjustments to all those instruments and the materials that will support the study. And then in the fall year, in fall 2018, we'll begin work on the main study. And so that includes training, the data collection phase, which the time study is kind of the primary focus of the data collection phase, but also includes focus groups, which we refer to as Delphi sessions. If you hear that terminology used, it's basically structured focus groups to get feedback on that time study data that's collected. And then possibly a supplemental survey will also be used as part of the time, as part of the judicial workload study. And then in the end, it comes back to us for data analysis and cleaning, which would take us to about spring of 2019. And then we estimate having a final report in June 2019. That sounds far away, but it's a pretty aggressive schedule, and we hope to keep to it. So those are kind of the key phases and the timeline of the study. All right. So I wanted to touch base on some of the kind of the key components here, and that's participation, both participation of the study in whole, as well as participation within the courts that are participating in the study. So we will look to include a representative sample of trial courts. We look at that in terms of size, geography, and region, as well as some other factors. So VET has been working diligently to look at kind of that sampling of those courts. So we look to include small, medium, large courts, rural, urban, and suburban courts, northern, central, southern, coastal courts. So we try to get a great representation across California of the courts that we include. In general, our goal is to have the participation of about 15 courts and approximately 800 judicial officers. This level of participation will kind of help us capture the full range of judicial workload across the state. So, and then with regard to participation at the court level, we are looking to include the participation of the full bench. This ensures that we capture the full universe of judicial workload to adequately capture need. So the full bench includes authorized judges, SJOs, referees, hearing officers, pro tem, temporary assigned, retired, and visiting judges. So that we do hope to capture everybody when we within the those participating courts. All right, and then a little bit about training. This is kind of a key component of doing this study. So prior to the time study, prior to that data collection phase, we will be providing pretty in-depth training to those participating courts. It's pretty critical that we do this up front, so then when the judicial officers are tracking the time, it lessens that burden of trying to figure out, you know, what they're capturing, what they're writing down. So we do really focus on providing an in-depth training. We will also look to provide training in different formats so that it doesn't have to be all on site. We look to have some maybe online, some sort of format that provides online training. We really want to meet differing schedules because we know that's going to be difficult to get everyone to one or two single sessions of training. So we will look to provide multiple training sessions. All judicial officers should attend the training. It's important that they all participate. Additionally, another component of the workload study is a lot of times we've seen in previous studies that we've done and in other states that have done these, staff sometimes do the data entry for the judicial officers. So we like to include the staff, any staff that would be participating to participate in that training as well. So that's a little bit about training. So let's get into the time study piece of it. So this is kind of the meat of the study. Time will be tracked during a 4 to 8 week time frame. So if some of you are familiar with the resource, the staff study, I think it was limited to about 4 weeks. And our goal is really to limit it to the least amount of time. We know it's a burden, but we found in earlier studies and other studies in state courts that we've looked at, because of the way judicial workload comes in, especially in the smaller courts, we can't capture everything in that 4 week period. So sometimes it needs to be extended out. In some instances, it's been 6 weeks. In some instances, it's been 8 weeks. We will continue to look at that because we do understand that that can be a burden to the court. Then in particular, the judges will track their time on a daily time log. This is kind of a paper-based tool, and so they can track their time daily. We will also have a web-based reporting tool. This would be kind of our preferable method that judges would enter time. So they would take that daily time log data and then enter it into some sort of web-based tool to enter that time. This is something that we will look at with the pilot courts. This would be something that we would test with the pilot courts. In the past, both methods have been accepted in terms of that data coming in, both the paper-based and the online-based. It's the paper-based, when it comes to us, can lead to data entry. It can lead to different things. So we do prefer the data to be entered web-based, but we do also understand we want to take whatever method the data is being given to us, if it's easier to do it on a time. But so that's something that we will look at with the time study and also maybe talk with others who can give us some input on the best way to do that. And please stop me if you have questions along the way. So this is just, and this is in your materials as well. This is just a draft sample of what that daily time log looks like. So this, again, this is a paper-based tool. The online tool will look different, but it will be structured in the same way in terms of the same categories. And so I will go through in the next slide some of the kind of main elements of this daily time log. All right, so the daily time log, as I said, as similar to the web-based tool, is structured around four main elements. So it's kind of that case type category. What case type are you working in? The phase of case, what phase of that case you are in, whether it's trial, post-disposition, that sort of thing. Case characteristics. This would be if applicable. Not all cases would have a case characteristic associated with them, but this might be something like a pro per or complex, so that you would check that box if that's a characteristic of a case that you're working on. And then we also capture non-case related activity on this instrument. So those are kind of the four elements that we will be capturing time on. What that doesn't mention is obviously you'd also be entering the time for each of those. All right, so how we have it organized, so then within the case type, within that element of the instrument, we have things broken down in case type. There's six main case type categories that I think you're all familiar with: criminal, civil, family law, juvenile, probate, and mental. But within those six categories is where we have the breakout of those specific case types. So currently, and this is taking in some of the things that Chris had talked about earlier, is some of those new case types that we'll be looking at. So right now we're looking at about 30. That might get whittled down. We might not, some of those new case types that we will be reporting in GIPSIS might not need to be separate case types here that we're collecting data on. But we do want to begin that process, even though the data that we'll be feeding this study initially might not have those breakdowns. We do want to start, we want to begin collecting data on those new case types. so that when we start moving into multiple years and doing those averages, we have the ability to go back and have that data included. So and just to kind of look through, so for criminal, it's not going to be collected in that aggregate. It's broken down into felony, misdemeanor, both traffic and non-traffic, infractions, as well as a couple other case type breakouts. So each of those have between five and six additional case types below them. And where you're going to see a big difference is that mental health category. So before, in previous studies, both the RAS as well as old previous judicial workload studies, mental health was kind of a single category. And now we're looking at about six case type breakout of mental health. And then we have to just look, do we need the full six, and how we kind of how we capture that data for mental health. So that'll be a little bit different in this go around. All right. So the other element of the study and the instrument itself is the phase of case. So the first four that we have listed here are those that we have used in the past, in the previous judicial workload studies, as well as you'll see this language in other judicial workload studies that are done in other states. So we have the pretrial predisposition, non-trial uncontested disposition, trial contested disposition, and post-trial post-disposition. So there's a series of activities that we would identify under those categories, and then you would enter your data based on those main categories. We have added a fifth, which is court supervision and probation, and that's something that some of that would have been entered in post-disposition. We thought because of the increased workload in this area, we might want to pull it out, but then again, we might not. So that's something, again, that we will kind of test with the pilot courts, but also accept feedback from all of you in terms of is this a necessary breakout or does it confuse matters? But we thought we would identify it because it has changed over the years to be able to include that. All right, so the other piece of this is case characteristics. And if you are familiar with the RAS or previous judicial workload studies, this is a pretty comprehensive list. So I think in the past we've had maybe three of these identified. So this is something that if you're working on a case and this is a characteristic of that case, you would mark a box that said, you know, this is a designated complex case. Now, where we have asbestos is an example of, this is generally a case type. It was a case type in RAS, and it's been mixed in the judicial workload studies where it's been a case characteristic or a case type. So we want to get feedback in terms of, should we put this back as a case type or keep it as a case characteristic? So these are just some of the questions we have in terms of how we're breaking out some of these case characteristics. Do they need to be here? Do they need to be moved back into a case type category? But we've added interpreter required is something new that we added this year, and I think pro-per litigants is something new that we added this year. And this is just from earlier studies that we've gotten feedback on that this might be something interesting, that this might be something necessary to capture. Okay, and then last but not least, is kind of the non-case related activity. So whereas we're collecting data on all the case related activity, we want to collect the full range of the schedule that it works. So we want not just case related activity, we want to capture that time related to those non-case related activities. So that includes the things you see here, vacation, sick leave, holiday, lunch, all those types of things. So that will also be on that instrument to be able to enter that time in those particular areas. So those are kind of the main topics. So again, we've provided kind of this broad overview. We would, and again, I mentioned this again, we would love to have a small group of people to kind of submit some of this too, to get feedback. Are we going in the right track? We are doing this in-house this time, We will have a consultant in certain pieces of it, but it won't be a full consultant-run study. And so we really want to use your expertise to kind of get feedback on some of the language or what we're including in the study. So if you are interested and available, the time frame would probably be in the next few months, kind of as we're working towards that pilot study to run some of these ideas by you.
Kristen, thank you very much for that. Do you know when it's due to the council, our goal?
So in terms of the timeline, we are, the final report we're looking at in about summer 2019. So, and that sounds far away, but it is a fair, looking at older, previous studies, it's gone on for a couple of years. So hoping to meet this schedule.
And who's the court that's already agreed to be a pilot?
Placer. So Placer is one of the pilot courts, and we will be working with them in late April.
And we had picked them because they participated in our RAS study,
mm-hmm.
and so the coordinator for that study on the RAS side will also sort the function judicial need, and they just had the right size bench where they're big enough where we could get varied feedback, but small enough where we could catch them as a pilot.
Yes.
The hesitation, for all of you that are new or that don't remember, the hesitation on this from courts is that judges don't like to keep time. And that's why they became judges. They're not lawyers. They don't have to tell you what they did all day, even though we need this information. And so I throw it out to the group, what's the best way to pitch it? Because we need large courts and small courts and inland courts and when we have the – and it is being done all in-house. And so if there's something out there that we don't know, that there's some rumble that this isn't going to work, we need to know now.
It has to be explained in a way that it's explained in the very first page or second page that this is basically judicial needs so that we can explain to the legislature why we need more judges. And I think if it is couched in those terms and articulated in a way that is succinct, they will understand that. Filling out lunch and break time, they're not going to understand that.
No, I know.
That's something maybe
and
small work.
And we also have to make sure they understand that it's anonymous. There was some concern in 2011, that was during a very tumultuous time in our state branch. And
there was a lot of concern that the information was going to be used in some form or fashion. And because we were outside, it was an outside group doing it then, I was actually still here. I was here then.
Anonymous, we do need for our purposes to be able to track the data. It is confidential. It is not anonymous in terms of the data that will come to us.
Just like the RAS data is not confidential. It is not where it came from. Mike?
Well, first of all, you're having participated in a couple of them.
Yes,
I set it up where we protected their identity, but we assigned them some kind of cases to me.
Yes.
So that if we're got out, they knew who to get. Is that something that
yes.
Another level of protection in terms of confidentiality?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what we had in mind.
Yeah.
The question is, indicate that you're looking for full bench participation.
Yes.
That could knock out a few counties. I think historically we would take like sections of the bench,
mm-hmm.
but overall you had critical mass necessary to give you the numbers. Is that off the table?
Off the table. It's that. So ideally, the full bench idea is to get as many participants as possible to give us the best.
I'm not sure they could get their entire court, and yet they've always been viewed as being critical to final outcome. So,
LA is I don't think it's off the table for any court, but for LA, yes, we would not. We usually have a single location or something like that we work with
in
LA.
Yeah, we might be similarly situated,
yes.
So that's why I just wanted to.
It's not off the table. It's ideal.
And it may be that I asked some of you guys when it comes time to go pitch this to some of our brethren and sisters. That we do it as a team, that we're not it's not staff asking, it's this committee asking for the help of our colleagues, and I'm speaking just to the judges, you know, that we go and we figure out how we can, you know, hit a few courts that are thinking about it and go talk to them. Yeah, Mike?
You got to get the PJs on board.
Right.
I mean, in your timeline, I hope you've incorporated a serious session at one of the upcoming meetings.
A PJ meeting in March.
You can detail this out for the PJs because that's also going to be an important component.
All right. We've now started to go and speak at the PJ CEO meetings whenever we try to pitch something or do something new. We didn't get on the calendar. We should have.
We didn't have enough yet to go. And
maybe we can
meet first with this group before we.
So we are trying to do that. But
so the next executive meeting for the PJs is April 4th. And then there's one in late May,
right?
And then everybody's together in August of this year, so.
Now, August is kind of late.
Yeah.
But
so, I mean, get one of those early ones.
Yeah.
So this is Sherry Carter, and I am not in the same location as Brian, who's also on the call from Los Angeles. So I just want you to know that I volunteer Brian to be on that small working group. To provide input into the form. Sorry, Brian. If that would be helpful, he could certainly.
I was on this call to avoid this stuff.
Yes, he could certainly help coordinate responses from various judicial components within Los Angeles. So if you're looking for a volunteer for input on the forms and the process, I volunteer Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Sherry, it'd be very helpful if your PJ would weigh in on this.
Oh, he won't care about the input on the forms at all because we
Not on the input on the forms, but on whether or not
on the measurement.
They can participate in any form. And if that's very helpful for me when I can pitch this and say LA is participating.
Yeah, I don't anticipate a lot. I think Judge Buckley and Judge Brazil, my APJ, will be very supportive of LA participating because I think it's important that the courts that have, you know, sometimes different types of cases that they be included. And so I don't think that'll be the struggle. I think the struggle will be getting participation by the judges who are actually being asked to do it. So I will add this to something to discuss with Judge Buckley. I don't think there will be any concern, but I will let you know about that for certain in terms of our participation. And you're right, we'd never get the whole bench, but if we looked at a courthouse, that would probably be workable. The problem is we don't have courthouses anymore that do all case types because of the budget reductions. We've consolidated so much of the work. So you might even want to think about doing that a little differently in LA. But we can talk later. I'll talk to Buckley. I'll be back in touch. But I do offer Brian's help to coordinate comments on the forms.
Thank you, Sherry.
Not going to take that call in another location, Brian.
Brian will never be on another call.
You know, another feature I want to just mention about the study that I think we're aiming for is, yeah, I think for those of you who follow along at the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee meetings, there's a recognition that the work of the smallest court, you know, doesn't conform perfectly to workload models. It's really hard to scale our models to fit the two-judge courts versus the courts with hundreds of judges. And so I think the plan is still to try to include a large enough group of the smallest courts so that we can really study whether or not there are differences in workload deployment amongst those small courts. And much in the way that we have created differentiation, for example, for infractions, caseways, and RAS, there may be some areas where judicial workload for certain matters is very different for the smallest courts and the largest ones. So more so than in our previous studies, we're going to be focusing on trying to get a lot of participation from the courts that have fewer judicial officers. That's another, just as it's important to get LA, we also want to hone in on the other side of the scale.
If you wanted me to, I can reach out because of the work I've been doing on the kickback committee. I've reached out to a lot of the cluster one, cluster two courts. If you wanted, I don't know what number you want for the pilot, but I can reach out to those folks and see if anybody's interested.
Okay. Yeah, maybe on our way out we can talk about doing that. Thank you.
Any other questions at this Are there any other volunteers besides Brian for the committee?
Yeah. This is Sharon from Fresno, and I'll volunteer Kevin Anderson.
And this is
I'll let him know all about it this afternoon.
We were envisioning originally some judges as well.
I'll volunteer.
So,
thank you.
And I can, besides getting the other people if you want.
Thank you.
And Sean, I'm sorry.
Are you looking for a court of a particular size to participate in the pilot besides Placer? And if so, what size court? Because Placer's, 12 judges?
Yeah. And for the pilots, we were looking for a kind of smaller,
Under
10, 12, somewhere like that size court. Yeah.
I'll approach my bench and see what they say. I'm not optimistic,
okay.
But I will ask.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. And we have six.
Okay.
And we're right next door to Placer.
Yeah.
Also can
we'll
you
out.
Might want to talk to your PJ and get your PJ to ask.
I will.
Yeah. I'd be happy to talk to your PJ.
Probably be best if I do.
No, but afterwards, give it a bump.
Okay, good. I'll let you know shortly, early next week.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
And if you need any information, we can provide that. Yeah.
Right. Any other questions?
Well, I guess I would just say on the volunteer issue, if you don't want to be on the spot and volunteer people, but if you know somebody who might be interested in being part of that group, then please contact Kristen directly. Through the WAC mailbox, and we'll get the information.
We are looking at sampling for courts for the larger study, which starts in fall. And so if you do know that you'd like to be part of that, you can always let us know.
How large is large?
For the larger study. So we are looking to have about 15 courts. And so if we know of courts that definitely want to participate, we will.
And do we know who participated last time? I don't remember. In 2011.
San Francisco did.
You did.
And
San Diego did not, nor did L.A.
We have so much going on right now with the challenges to our four bench officers that I'm going to talk to the PJ. I'm not going to volunteer Mike yet. I want to talk to him about this, but I mean, I'd be interested, but there's right now the critical months are between now and for us. And the challenge is the election day, June. Yeah. So.
Well, the large study doesn't start until
September, October.
Yeah. So you may have volunteers, may include me, but I just need to see what we're going to do in terms of managing. Right now, we're in a firestorm, so we're just trying to figure out what we need to do with regard to how we're going to fill in and do assignments and stuff like that. So,
and this is,
take time off.
We do have to provide this report to the legislature, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So we have, judges need to know that this account.
So this feeds into our biennially we produce a judicial needs assessment, which is our report to the legislature that shows how many judges are needed statewide. So the last time that report went to the council in 2016, one of the questions raised was, our need is based on case weights at the time we're 5 years old. And so when we go to the legislature the next time around, which will be this fall, we'll have to determine how we do that. But it will be on the basis that we have this pending study, which will update the workload need for judges.
Yeah, I think beyond all that, the real issue is we're not going to stand much of a chance of getting the additional judges that a lot of the counties need unless we've got a timely study under them. I mean, it's just not going to fly in the legislature. So, I mean, that seems to be an overriding consideration we need to keep in mind.
Right, incumbent upon the counties that really need the judges to participate.
And you want me to my PJ.
Okay, good. Yeah, the last one was 2011.
Yeah, here's the course we did it last time.
Yeah, so in 2010 we had the Alameda, Butte, El Dorado, Lake, Merced, San Bernardino, San Francisco, San Benito, Santa Clara, Sonoma, Imperial, Glen, Fresno, Inyo, and Siskiyou. And so while it is always good to have some of the courts repeat because we can study trends over time, We know it's not always possible, and so it's good to have a combination of both courts that participated the last time plus some new courts to form the workload measures.
All right, well, unless somebody else has any other questions, I think we'll follow up with the status of how this is going, who's volunteered, who the pilots are through emails or maybe a conference call, and keep you guys updated, knowing that we have that timeline where we have to get this done by September of 2019, or the fall of 2019 to give it to the council. And the next thing will happen with this group is that I will present to the council these RAS numbers in May. They've asked me to come and present those, and that would then go for the fiscal year 18-19's budget. Yes?
If we find that the judge or the personnel year value is different.
We have until May, right?
Is the plan to try to incorporate that into the May report to the council?
I think that would be incumbent on how quickly we can get verification of that information, but I think we're going to bring it back to the committee to.
It actually works out that that normally we would have brought this to the council at the beginning of March, but now because there's a conflict, we're not bringing it. That I have a conflict, we're not bringing it till May. So maybe that'll be luck. Good luck.
But the issue of the year value would affect all courts equally for the most part. There might be some marginal differences with small courts with rounding, so it shouldn't change any of the preliminary allocation percentages very much.
So going back to Mike's question, I do think that if there's any way that we can incorporate the new hours, it's important because I might have this percentage a little wrong, but I think the branch need reflected almost a 10% reduction overall because of using those numbers. If we find that those numbers should be different, I think that we should include them because it's sending the wrong message, in my opinion.
But that's what we're planning on doing, Sherry, is having Zlatko get us the information as soon as he can, and then we'll send you out an email. And if
right.
we need to have a conference call because something's different, we need to have a quick vote, then we'll have it. Like I said, we've got between now and May 25th, I think is my date. All right. With that, we're going to conclude the meeting unless anybody has anything else that's good for the order here. You want to add? No?
No, I want to get on the road.
Okay. Meeting adjourned. Thank you guys for participating by phone.
Thank you. Bye.